Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. What should we do about the deer population? Worthington is the latest community to wrestle with this question of how to contain wildlife while coexisting with nature. The deer dilemma has been around for decades, but it is getting worse. More people simply means more development. Fewer predators mean less fear. And it all means more deer roaming into our gardens and darting into our traffic. So the question becomes, do we feed them? Do we poison them, shoot them, sterilize them, recognize that we've disrupted their ecosystem by eliminating both their enemies and their habitats? These are not easy questions to answer. But Worthington City Manager Robin Stewart is trying to find solutions, and she joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Robin.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
When we talk about exploding populations in Central Ohio, we're usually talking about all the people moving here. But the white-tailed deer population is growing almost as fast as the people. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in Worthington?
We have quite a few deer in Worthington, and it's become quite the community conversation. We recognize that that habitat for the deer has changed over time in Ohio as a state, but also in Worthington specifically.
Oh, my God. Oh, I'm sorry. That's not you. That's me. That was something on my iPad that popped up. I apologize. By the way, continue. So the deer population has continued to grow here in Worthington. And what brought it all to a head? What made you decide, you know what? We need a task force.
We've had a community conversation about it for a little while. For quite a few years, we've received some calls and concerns expressed about the deer from our residents, but those have increased notably in the last few years. So our city council decided that a direction of a task force to engage the community, more fully evaluate the issue and the situation and the options, was the prudent path forward at this point. So we have a task force that is looking into that issue and preparing to make some recommendations to our city council.
You had your first meeting, a public meeting last week, and 100 people showed up. So clearly the people in your community have very big feelings about the deer and what to do about them. What was your response to just 100 people showing up?
We know it's a topic of focus for many of our residents. It's a bit of a hot topic in Worthington these days. Our task force has actually been meeting for a little over 6 months as they've gotten organized and looked into the issue. This spring, they actually conducted a community survey to gauge community attitudes and perspectives around deer and possible strategies. So we knew there was a high response rate to the survey, so we anticipated we may have a fair number of people show up in person. They're in the midst of educational sessions. Our first educational session was the one you just mentioned, and we did have over 100 people attend to learn more about deer.
I want to talk about that response rate in just a moment, but I want to invite all of you listening to join the conversation. Do you have problems with your deer in your backyard? How do you feel about lethal methods of culling them, sterilization, feeding deer? If you have a thought, we'd love to hear it. Give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email your comments to allsides@wosu.org. So yeah, you had about 3,000 people respond to that survey. You have a population of 14,000?
Yes, a little over that, but yes, about 14,000.
So we're talking a 30% response rate to your survey.
If you look at the adult population, and we did track the respondents, and they ranged in ages from the 18 to 24 age range all the way up to 80 plus. And we know we had a lot of engagement in that survey. About 3,100 of the responses were from city residents. We actually had another 800 for people that don't live in the city. But about 3,100 of those were from the community itself.
I mean, we were talking about this before the show started, but that's a response rate that social scientists would kill for.
It's definitely probably a very enviable response rate that we saw. And it's a higher response than we see in some of our other surveying that we conduct, which shows how much people are thinking about deer and are feeling the impacts of deer.
When it comes to the types of complaints that you as a city get, where do deer rank on that list?
That's hard to say because we are city government, so we are involved in many different service areas. So we've never actually totaled up the number of concerns that are expressed related to deer versus other dynamics and issues in Worthington. However, we do, particularly since we've started the task force, I should say, we've received quite a few comments. We've opened that conversation, and the task force has let the community know that we want to hear their thoughts and concerns. And so we've been getting even more of those in this past year.
Worthington enacted a no feeding policy when it comes to deer about 2 years ago. And that is something that you can track. How many complaints have there been about people feeding the deer?
Since we've started receiving those complaints, since that ordinance went into effect, we've had about 15 reports of deer feeding, which we have followed up and investigated. Some of those were found to be unfounded, but others were found to be in violation of the ordinance. And we work with the people who are doing the feeding to try to change that behavior and come into compliance.
And that's a complicated thing because I think feeding deer may happen in your backyard, out of view of other people. And I do want to be clear that having, say, corn for the squirrels or a bird feeder, this does not count as feeding the deer, correct?
We will educate that there are strategies you can take with your deer, with your bird feeder, so that it's not feeding deer. And sometimes people are putting out food for other animals. We actually suggest that it's not a good practice to feed any wildlife. It changes their natural behaviors, makes them less fearful of humans, and can lead to some more challenging and aggressive interactions over time. So we certainly encourage people to not feed generally wildlife. Obviously, a lot of people like to feed birds. Those are a little different dynamic there. And there are feeders that can make it more challenging for other wildlife to access that food.
Speaking of, you know, changing behaviors, there was a woman who stood up at the meeting that you had last week and said she'd been attacked by a deer, pummeled to the ground. I mean, when we think of deer, I think we conventionally think of Bambi. We don't think of something that might attack a human, but bucks, particularly when they're in rut in the fall, can be dangerous.
Well, and I will clarify for those who attended the meeting, because there may be some listening today, it was actually the husband of the woman who had the interaction with the deer that was there and shared her story. This occurred during fawning season, and it was a doe. And so we have been sharing messages with the community about being cautious around deer during fawning season. We know the deer have become very acclimated to humans. They are not as scared of humans, and they will protect their young. It's a natural instinct for the does to do so. We also find that most of the reports of aggressive deer that we receive are tied to people who are walking their dogs. And there is a long history with that deer just behavior, and it's the natural instinct of the deer to protect against members of the canine family. Those are traditional predators for the young and the fawns, whether you're thinking wolves or coyotes or your family dog. The deer instinctively doesn't trust that dog. So we encourage people to really be cautious if they're out walking their dogs around the does, especially during fawning season, and maybe even divert their route or move away from them so that they don't come in close contact.
I want to talk about how we might begin to solve the overpopulation of deer, particularly here in central Ohio. So officials in New Albany have allowed the use of sharpshooters. Gahanna used to allow bow hunting to cull the herds. And Franklin County Metro Parks have also used sharpshooters. About 350 deer annually are humanely killed and processed for meat given to food banks. This is a very controversial idea, but where do you come down on this kind of herd management?
We haven't yet identified our specific recommendations for management strategies. We are studying what other communities have pursued, what has worked well for them, and also tried to find some lessons learned for things that didn't work well. Our survey from the spring asked preliminarily about those lethal strategies, and we found our community was on two very different perspectives for those strategies. While we had a number of people that strongly supported those strategies to reduce the numbers of deer in Worthington, we also had a number of people that expressed strong opposition to those. That's why we are engaging in some of these educational sessions to create more information, more understanding. Our survey showed that not everybody understood how those programs might be rolled out if they were pursued. And there are often quite a few controls and regulations to curb or protect against some of the public safety messages or concerns that people are expressing. So we haven't yet taken a position on those strategies, but we do know that our survey results showed a high interest in fewer numbers of deer in Worthington. There are many people that appreciate the deer, but think the numbers are just too large, as they have grown quite a bit in recent years.
I want to take a call from Mike in Upper Arlington, who wants to talk about a solution that the Metro Parks tried years ago to solve the deer population. Welcome to All Sides, Mike.
Thank you. I'm a geologist. I own an environmental consulting firm. Tangentially, I've been involved with similar things. Biology is not my wheelhouse. But one thing I recall is that with Sharon Woods, you know, we consulted experts. The community wanted to relocate. They thought that was the humane thing to do. The experts said, no, look, that results in really high mortality. You know, it ends up being a very inhumane and largely lethal method. But eventually they gave in and they tried relocating them, and it was catastrophic. I've spoken to peers in the Canadian provincial park systems where they've had similar problems, such as at the pinery. And the only solution that they found was humane and lethal. There just wasn't another option that was viable. And too often people let emotion win out over reason. And I'll say this before I hang up. I am a bleeding heart when it comes to wildlife. You know, I love the deer in my neighborhood. But, man, sometimes we just create problems that we have to use ugly solutions for, and I'm afraid this is likely to be one of them.
Thank you, Mike. Yeah, I think one of the things that, and we're going to talk about this a little more when we have a representative from ODNR join us in this conversation, but, you know, you talked about dogs appearing as predators for deer. We don't have a ton of natural predators for deer left in central Ohio, and that may be contributing to this overpopulation. So in some ways, you can think about culling as replacement for the loss of that natural predator.
Right. We have changed the environment for deer quite a bit. They don't have the natural predators that they used to have. And historically, humans have hunted deer for food and for survival and for the resources that they provide. So the human predation has been removed. The other natural predators, the bears, the wolves, other wildlife have been removed from the environment. And we've also changed their access to food. So historically, the food environment would become more scarce. The higher the deer population, the more feeding that occurred. And so that would impact deer behavior and their fertility. But in a suburban environment like Worthington, when they eat the landscape is replenished. So the food reappears, and you don't have the same limiting factors from that food source that you would in an environment where humans weren't as prevalent.
I do also want to say that culling Worthington's deer population, those lethal ways of reducing the herd, wouldn't be free of charge. Skinning and processing a single deer can cost $150. You'd have to pay shooters to bait deer, deploy guns, equipment, messaging around safety. Like, this would not be a cheap solution to the deer problem.
Many communities that go down the path of the lethal measures and end up with some form of culling of the herd, they often put forth resources, a budget toward paying for the processing and then donation of the meat so that it is put to a productive use and can be used to feed people who are looking for that food source and maybe help some populations that may have more food scarcity.
And if you want to join our conversation about what to do with the deer population, you can give us a call this hour at 614-292-8513 or email your comments to allsides@wosu.org. You know, it isn't just Worthington that is dealing with an explosion of deer population here in central Ohio. And I want to take a call from Amy in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides, Amy.
Oh, thank you. Yes. In fact, it's not just a problem in Worthington. It's not quite a problem here yet. But up until a couple of years ago, I never...
Unfortunately, I think we had a really bad connection with Amy. The notes that I have here in front of me said that she had never seen deer, but now she sees them in her front yard. And my understanding is that Clintonville actually has a rather substantial deer problem.
We have heard from a few residents of Clintonville. We know some of them responded to our survey, and some have just anecdotally interacted with members of our task force or our city staff. So we know some residents in Clintonville who are talking about the deer also.
And I'll say I live up in Delaware, and as more and more of that farmland where deer do feed, they love a good corn buffet, gets replaced by suburban housing, we are seeing more and more deer just popping up in our own backyards.
Yes, I think we hear those stories from a variety of places. We actually find in some of our research that it can be beneficial if neighboring communities and jurisdictions work in concert with strategies that they pursue. I know there's a number of communities up in the Cleveland area, suburban communities that are adjacent to each other that communicate and coordinate with each other on the strategies that they're pursuing. So while we are right now looking specifically at Worthington, we anticipate we'll have conversations with other communities around us as we move into the direction that we want to pursue.
Speaking of those conversations, your next public meeting is set for the end of August. When do you anticipate the task force making recommendations?
The task force expects to be working throughout the remainder of this calendar year. So sometime around the end of the year is probably when they'll have their recommendations to move forward. As I mentioned about the survey showing that we have people on different ends of the spectrum in terms of support or concern about methods and strategies that we might pursue, we wanted to take time to do some education this summer, talk more details about the problem that we're experiencing now and possible solutions moving forward. And then the task force is expected to reflect on all of that, maybe have some additional community engagement, possibly another survey drilling down into more of the specific strategies to then make recommendations back to City Council. But we really wanted to see if by taking some time to do education and more community conversation, if we can bring people closer together on the direction that we ought to move forward with.
That's Worthington City Manager Robin Stewart. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up, how the Ohio Department of Natural Resources thinks about herd management. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. From Ohio's earliest days as a state, forests have blanketed our land, offering up a veritable feast for deer and other wildlife. But that's not really the case anymore. As central Ohio's population swells, green space shrinks. And with every structure that goes up and every roadway that goes in, deer have fewer and fewer places to call home. Joining me now to talk about what we're doing with our deer population is Gary Comer, who works for the Ohio Division of Wildlife as the Wildlife Management Supervisor for District 1. He's also the ODNR representative on Worthington's task force. Welcome to All Sides, Gary.
Good morning.
And still with us this hour is Worthington City Manager Robin Stewart. Worthington has convened a task force to decide next steps on culling or caring for its deer population. Thanks for sticking with us, Robin.
Happy to be here.
So, you know, Gary, when we talk about deer, the image of Bambi kind of looms large in these conversations. Deer in Disney's movies are portrayed as adorable, lovable, vulnerable. I mean, who among us hasn't oohed and aahed when we see a baby deer out and about in our own backyard? But they are still wild animals. And I think it's worth reminding that they still need to be treated with distance and respect.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I got into the field of wildlife management because I enjoyed seeing and interacting with wildlife, but the key to that is keeping that interaction at a distance.
Yeah. I mean, we talked earlier about a woman in Worthington whose husband has described she was attacked by a female deer protecting her doe. So is that unusual? Do you guys get calls from about deer attacks across the state?
Unfortunately, it's becoming more and more common. So it's not unusual. It's pretty much seasonal. And as Robin mentioned earlier, it surrounds fawning season. The issue with that is fawning season is kind of extended a little bit, but the peak of fawning is around the first part of June. Fawns start coming as early as April and maybe even late March, and then it could run all the way through August or even September, depending on the age of the doe.
I want to take a call from Adam in Worthington, who has some apple trees in his backyard, which I'm going to assume mean you also have a bunch of deer. Welcome to All Sides, Adam.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
Yes.
The deer are in our yard starting about this time of year, every single morning, every single evening. And we love watching them. We have three sons. They love watching them. And one thing that's kind of unsettling is how calm they are around people. We can go outside and get the kids in the van, and the deer will barely even notice us. They might only be 10 or 15 feet away, and we don't let the kids go up and play with them or anything. It's just that, you know, the kids can be outside yelling and the deer, it's like they don't even notice.
Yeah, Gary, I mean, they've gotten really used to us, which is not the way it was when Ohio became a state just 200 years ago.
No, absolutely not. I'm glad to hear that you're not letting your children interact that closely. They have become extremely habituated, and the lack of predator presence, or even, you know, that can come in multiple forms, but the natural predators, as was mentioned earlier, have been long since removed from the landscape. So that kind of leaves man-made predation, some coyote predators, potential car collisions. Those are not the ideal way of reducing populations.
Yeah. The other impact of deer is obviously with vehicle-related crashes. Since 2018, there's been more than 100,000 vehicle crashes, according to State Highway Patrol. They've resulted in 34 deaths and property damage in almost all cases. How do you guys think about population management in terms of deer and car collisions?
Well, I can't say that we specifically try to manage deer populations, but that is a key factor. You know, our goal is to try to keep enough deer on the landscape to be enjoyed by everyone, including hunters and wildlife photographers, enthusiasts, but to try to keep numbers in control so that agriculture doesn't receive unneeded impact, as well as deer vehicle collisions.
I want to talk a little bit about the positions that ODNR and the Ohio Division of Wildlife take and don't take. So when it comes to lethal population control methods, like sharpshooters, like bow and arrow, like extended hunting seasons, ODNR doesn't take a position on these choices, correct?
Well, we have the statutory authority over season regulations, bag limits, that kind of thing. But when it comes to municipalities, they have local rule. So we don't dictate or even necessarily make recommendations on what methods to take. That's completely a community decision, and we're there to help with things like permitting, regulatory oversight, technical assistance, and just support.
Is that why you're on this Worthington task force when it comes to management of deer population?
I would hope so. You know, I'll point out I'm a non-voting member so that I can stay biased. But, you know, I've known Robin for a number of years, and we've been talking about deer in Worthington for quite some time. I have some coworkers in that area. That's usually a discussion point. And, yeah, that's why I'm at the table, to help out.
You know, I want to ask you a question about deer themselves. You know, there's lots, and this may be a little bit beyond the scope of your expertise, but I'm going to see if you can answer, which is, you know, deer have lots of things in the environment that they eat, but what is it about our gardens that draw them into the fold? Like, what is it about my tomato plants in particular that perhaps are so alluring to the deer population of Central Ohio?
Well, I believe it's accessibility primarily. Those are unnatural food sources, as you pointed out. And for the same reasons that we enjoy those foods, deer do as well. Also, you know, they're renewable. They're always there. They come back seasonally, and it's easy access. Think about this. You know, if you put free candy out on the playground, you know, kids are going to come, right? So you plant gardens and beautiful landscape and very palatable plant choices, the deer are going to come if they're in the area.
I want to take a call from Miriam in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides, Miriam.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I did the COSI thing years ago about trying alternatives to shooting deer, and I've seen the some of the studies recently where top predators are returned to environments and the entire ecosystem flourishes. So I'm going to jump ahead to the inevitable conclusion that some sort of lethal method will probably have to be used. And I wonder if a significant portion of those licenses and of that meat could go to the Native American populations, if they'd be interested in it, because I'm just wondering if it would be more politically acceptable. Effectively, these were the people who were managing this wildlife population before, and we're going to let them manage it now. And then if there's excess, perhaps set up some sort of a zoo supply program so that instead of, I don't know what the lions and tigers and bears and things eat now, but I would think deer meat should be acceptable for them too.
Thanks for your call, Miriam. You know, we talked earlier that the metro parks do use SARP shooters to cull the herds, and a lot of that meat ends up at food banks. So I do think, Gary, no matter what we choose to do with it, there seems to be a desire to do something, like just not to let it rot somewhere.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's a much more palatable decision if that resource can be utilized. You know, one average deer can provide about 200 meals. So regardless of what population needs that protein or is utilizing it, it can go a long way. It's not the most economical protein, but, you know, it's enjoyed by a lot of folks, including recreational hunters.
If you want to join the conversation this hour, if you think culling the deer population is what's necessary, if you favor non-lethal methods, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. Robin, I want to bring you back into this conversation because I want to talk a little bit with both of you about how you would set up any kind of deer management program, whether it's sterilization, whether it's culling, whether it's fencing. I mean, all of this is going to require time. It's going to require money, may require a little bit of infrastructure.
Right. So those are the types of conversations we are having with our task force. I will note our caller earlier in the show, before Gary joined us, who was talking about some of the experience that Metro Parks has with trapping and relocation. We have a number of members of our community through our survey that had suggested that we look at that. Gary can chime in here, but that's not a strategy that is effective. As our caller noted, some of the past experiences with it have indicated that because of the high stress that is created from being trapped with the deer, they tend to not survive the relocation anyway, but it is a very stressful process for them. So that's not really a strategy that we expect to be able to pursue, but we are looking at the other different avenues and options out there. We are also sharing information with our community, and we'll continue to share information about things that individual households can do around deer strategies, because even if we implement some kind of program to reduce the numbers, we still will have deer in our community. And so we want to encourage that coexistence in a positive way.
Gary, is that correct, that relocation does not work?
Yeah, it's absolutely not a current option. As the caller mentioned earlier, and I'll confirm that stress and mortality rates are high. They go through a lot of unneeded stress, so a humane method is much more desirable, in my opinion, and I believe a lot of other folks agree with that.
Are there sterilization methods? Do those work?
There are practices that are being researched and experimented with. Currently in Ohio, those programs are experimental and only allowed by permit from the chief of the Division of Wildlife. And there's a couple of places up in the one place in the northeast of the state and one down to the southwest. And results are varied. It really depends who you're talking to, interpreting the resources. But if you think about it from this standpoint, it doesn't lower the population very quickly. It has been proven to be very effective in closed environments, maybe such as an island where there's not ingress and egress of the animals. But currently, it's not a very worth it. It's very expensive and it's not very efficable.
When it comes to those lethal methods, bow and arrow, sharpshooting, gun seasons, how does ODNR work with local communities? Like, how do you do this in a safe way? Because I have to assume it's not, hey, if you're sitting on your back porch and a deer wanders in, you can go ahead and get your gun.
No, absolutely not. Well, we, as I said earlier, we provide some technical assistance. Municipalities have to set their local code and ordinances. You know, we have a very liberal archery season here in the state, as well as some firearm dates as well. But that has got to be set up by the local police and service safety directors, city managers. But we will assist with that.
I would think, Robin, particularly if you were going to do it in a park over a period of set dates.
I think any program we would pursue if we end up at that step would be similar to what you see in some other communities, which are very structured programs. If it's archery hunting, you typically would pre-qualify hunters, make sure they're proficient. There are specific properties with specific time frames and other safety precautions taken. Oftentimes, you're looking for elevated the hunter to be elevated above the ground so that they're shooting toward the ground with those with the bows.
Yeah, you never shoot uphill.
Right. In the case of trained markspeople and professional markspeople, those would typically be specific dates, times, locations, obviously highly skilled and qualified people who most of the time they're using firearms in that environment. But it would not be a free-flowing program for anybody who wants to do something just because they get fed up that day or that week. But it would be highly structured with a lot of pre-qualification associated with it.
I want to take a call from Tim in Danville. Welcome to All Sides.
Hi.
You had a comment about the damage that deer do to farms?
Yeah. I've been farming out in Knox County for 30 years, and I raised actually mostly vegetables. And there's past 10 years, there's certain vegetables I can't grow at all out here anymore. But, I mean, I know they do a lot of economic damage to alfalfa fields and things like that. And it's always been my understanding that the Department of Natural Resources and wildlife managers have just maximized the deer population for deer licenses and the huge economic impact that hunters bring into the state. So that's the way I see it. And it's just amazing that the amount of deaths, 33 deaths over 5 years from these, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of crazy to think that, like, in the last decade or two, he's had to stop growing certain kinds of crops.
Well, there are some tools in place that can assist producers. Deer damage permits, you know, fencing is often the golden rule, which I know can be very expensive. But you're talking about some high-dollar crops there with truck crops and other commodities that over time should pay for itself. But as far as maximizing the deer herd, that has basically occurred organically. Land use changes. Deer are an edge species. At the beginning of settlement, you know, Ohio's lost 20 million acres of forest. Deer were never big forest animals. They lived on the edge. So if you think about how we've changed everything, agricultural fields, edge of woodlots, fence rows, things like that in cities. You know, we're creating environments. So quite honestly, the habitat has changed, not been limited for deer.
That's a really good point, because they've always sort of lived at the edge of where the forest meets the meadow.
Absolutely.
We're going to take a quick break, but coming up, we're going to continue to look for solutions to the deer dilemma. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
WOSU's Politics and a Pint is back, and we certainly have a lot to talk about. Join me, Mike Thompson, All Sides host Anna Staver, and a panel of reporters to discuss this incredible 2024 campaign and wash down that political talk with a pint or two. It's Thursday, August 15th at 6 at 7th Sun Brewing in Italian Village. Go to WOSU.org/events to register.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about deer and how communities are managing their ever-increasing numbers. Some communities allow bow and arrow hunting to call herds. Some, like Worthington, are still in search of solutions. Still with us this hour is Gary Comer, who works for the Ohio Division of Wildlife as the Wildlife Management Supervisor for District 1. He's also ODNR's non-voting representative on Worthington Task Force. Thanks for sticking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And still with us is Worthington City Manager Robin Stewart. Thanks for sticking around as well.
Happy to be here, so.
So, you know, you said something right before the break that I want to circle back to, and it's that deer live on the edge of forests, that they don't frolic through the forest, regardless of how Disney may portray their lives, and that the way that we have developed here in the state of Ohio, we're actually making their habitat area bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as the they still utilize woodlots, and but they need, you know, all wildlife need the basic food, cover, and space. So with a lot of our subdivisions and developments, you know, we're putting in green spaces. It's even mandated at times, things like stormwater retention ponds, prairies, you know, open meadows. But yeah, it's absolutely a perfect environment for deer.
But yet there was a time in the early 1900s when the deer population was nearly wiped out. There were even deer exhibits at the zoo.
Yeah, that's right. You know, as settlement came and deforestation and agricultural practices, it was unregulated. There weren't regulations on hunting. There was still market hunting. And it finally took some very wise individuals to realize, hey, we might want to make these sustainable resources. I don't think at the time they realized how prolific the comeback of the white-tailed deer would be in the Midwest, but that's kind of where first wildlife laws and conservation movement came into place.
And when we're talking about deer and conservation and ecosystems, I have to ask, how has the lack of natural predators not only affected the growth of the white-tailed deer population here, but the health? I mean, we hear a lot about wasting disease and other health issues plaguing the deer populations.
Well, I can't really speak to the direct effects of predator loss, but, you know, I can say that in general, any wildlife population, deer included, when they become too dense or too numerous in numbers, a limiting factor will take place one way or the other, either through predation or human predation, or at some point disease will take place. As habitat degrades and herd health degrades, Mother Nature will take a balance Unfortunately, it probably look a lot worse than even the old Sharon Woods relocation stress, and that was obviously not a good practice.
Which leads me to my next question, which is, what about wolves? Why not bring back the natural predators that deer have? They're doing it out west.
Well, you know, that is a very common, and, you know, that would be great. But, you know, the wolves themselves do require certain habitat requirements. And in those more vast open areas in the West, they can support and become part of the ecosystem. It's somewhat controversial, as you're pretty much aware of, but from both hunters and livestock producers. But in the Midwest, with the population densities, it would not be tolerated, nor would the animals survive. They would probably get hit by cars or other mortality before they could ever take hold.
It's not a simple thing to simply reintroduce wolves either.
No, it's not.
I want to take a call from Doug in Reynoldsburg. Welcome to All Sides, Doug.
Hey, Anna, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm just curious because I'm one of those kids that still remembers going to Black Lake Woods in the late 60s, early 70s with the deer enclosure that you were trying to reintroduce the deer population. Did you ever think that you would be having this conversation that there were too many deer when, in fact, I heard you, you know, just talking about the deer at the zoo and things, but is this kind of an unintended consequence, or was there a thought about what you might do if the deer population got this much? And I'll take it off the air. It's a great program. Thank you.
Well, I'm not aware of the program that he's talking about. You know, whitetail introduction back to the state of Ohio began much earlier than the 60s. And I don't think even at that time in the 20s and 30s that they expected quite the development and the changes to the landscape. I do know of exclosures versus enclosures that are to basically demonstrate the effect of the herbivores, deer, on browse for native plants and forest regeneration. But I'm not sure what that gentleman was talking about.
That is kind of crazy to think that even as late perhaps as the 60s or 70s, we were still upping the population, and now we're talking about lowering the population.
Yeah, I can remember even as a kid, I harvested my first deer in 1979. I won't tell you how old I was, but I was young. And, you know, there were men and other hunters well into their 60s that had never harvested a deer. They came to see the deer the kid harvested. And it was one of the first antlerless permits that was issued by the Division of Wildlife. Back then it was a postcard. You applied in writing and they sent this in the mail.
Oh my goodness.
So we were really excited when I got one, because I can remember hunting deer days after days and even a few years without even seeing a deer. So when I got the opportunity, but that was one of the techniques that the division started implementing, the take of antlerless deer. And it took several generations for our hunting population to even think that that was ethical, because they were trying to help grow the herd at that time, the hunters were. And antlerless deer, primarily the females, as you well know, are the ones that have the fawns. So that was why that stigma around not harvesting antlerless deer began. And it's become a big challenge to manage herds. There's still some of that that exists.
Oh my goodness, my father-in-law has a real strong objection to taking female deer. I bet you this is why. I've never considered it.
It was a cultural thing. You know, depending on someone's age, they absolutely can remember. I've heard dozens of stories where my best friend's mother was taken out of school by her father just to go to the farm to see a deer track. And so that's literally where we've came from and where we're at now.
Robin, does that surprise you as well? Because I'm sitting here going, oh my goodness, like, we used to be so protective of them, and now we're just like, oh my gosh, how do we get rid of these guys?
It is funny to hear that story, because I think I see deer tracks in my front yard just about several times a week, maybe
yeah,
even every
even
day.
A breaking so news event at my house.
Yes, there are many deer tracks out there, but I have heard some of the history of the deer populations in Ohio, and so from that perspective, it doesn't surprise me, because obviously there were quite a few deer when Ohio became a state, but then 100 years later, there were virtually no deer in the state. It sounded like, just based on records and stories, but now yet another 100 years later, we have them all over the place.
I know we've been talking about deer this hour, but I also want to ask you, Gary, about rabbits, because they are everywhere too.
Well, you know, this is time of year that you're going to see, you know, they're a very high fecund species, meaning they have a high birth rate. They also have a high death rate. So seasonally, those resources are here now. You know, it's green. The weather's nice. They can have a couple, two, three litters a year. And we expect, you know, they were a prey item. And so without that predator out there, you know, the thing that's going to limit them, you know, there's still plenty of predation for rabbits, but is, you know, cycle up and down. So I would expect to see a lot of rabbits this time in the summer. And the same goes for wildlife areas. We're seeing a lot of rabbits as well.
And people have the same kind of complaints. They eat my garden. They destroy my flowers. They pick on my trees. Like, do you guys get complaints about rabbits as well?
We don't hear rabbits as much. We get a few other wildlife complaints. We certainly have rabbits. I know in my neighborhood, I see them on a regular basis, and I do live in Worthington as well as work there. But we sometimes hear about raccoons or coyotes or other wildlife that also exist in Worthington.
It's such a delicate balance, right? Because I think we all love seeing them in our backyards, but we all hate if they disturb our backyard. It's this like delicate come in and like hang out, but like please don't touch anything.
Yeah, that's really hard to communicate. It's like teaching children not to touch something that's hot. They got to experience that firsthand, unfortunately.
And there's all kinds of crazy theories about how to keep them out. Like, I've heard everything from, you know, if you have little boys, let them pee around your garden, to planting certain types of flowers, to using certain kinds of chemicals, to getting like coyote urine off the internet. Do any of these work?
Well, you know, I wouldn't want to come right out and say none of them work, but let's talk about repellents and things in general. You know, they have to be applied frequently and often, and it can become expensive. And I think animals are just like, in some ways, a rabbit may be averse to a certain odor, smell, or a chemical that's applied to a plant to avert their taste. Others may not like it. The other thing is a lot of these things that they talk about, like deer-resistant plants or less palatable, it doesn't mean they won't browse on them. You know, they're as smart as they are, they may take a few bites, then they go, oh, I don't like that. Then they walk on, they come back by, oh, let's try it again. So you're still going to see some browsing. And then if environmental conditions were to become extremely bad, they're going to get to where they pick other food sources as a last resort.
So essentially, it doesn't matter if you're peeing in your backyard, you're really not doing anything to keep them away.
No, I can't say that it would work. But I know folks that swear by it. And you know what? It doesn't hurt anything. So if you want to continue to try it, hats off to you.
Yeah, it would be a cheap alternative. If you order that kind of urine off the internet, it can get pretty pricey, especially if you're putting it down every time that it rains, which you would really need to do to be effective.
Yeah, if you're going to try to implement repellents, it has to be applied, as I said, liberally and thoroughly and very frequently.
Would a salt lick distract them? Like, if you put food in one place, can you keep them off another place? I know we're not supposed to feed them.
Well, yeah, we don't want to introduce artificial minerals either, especially in a suburban area. You know, there is some research out there that suggests maybe alternative feeding sites for certain species. But in the end, you're concentrating animals for a period of time that allows a lot of contact and potential for disease spread. And, you know, I don't know anybody that doesn't want to see healthy wildlife. Maybe they want to see it reduced in a more sustainable size, but no one wants to see sickly wildlife.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit earlier about wasting disease, which if you're somebody who hunts in Ohio, then you know all about it and what it means and what to look for and what to do with the animal if you kill one with it. It's a difficult conversation.
Yeah, it is. It's a tough conversation because it's somewhat of an invisible disease, because a lot of the animals that become infected or CWD is detected in will on the exterior look very healthy, even robust. But what we know from science, and this goes back to the emotions that was discussed early. You know, it's hard to look at a real healthy animal and understand that there may be something there. But mortality rates, not necessarily from chronic wasting disease, are increased. We know that. Their mental capacity is somewhat diminished, meaning they could be more susceptible to hunting, predation, or even struck by cars. But even more so, they're more susceptible to infections. There's a lot of things out there that deer succumb to. It's a tough world. They don't go to the doctor or the vets.
We're almost out of time this hour, but I want to get in a quick email comment who wanted to know about the increase in Lyme disease in Ohio and how the deer may be contributing.
Well, that's a great question. So, yeah, I can acknowledge that Lyme disease used to be, oh, that's something in the East, you know, did you visit, when people would talk about it. But I want to point out that, you know, that's directly related to tick populations and ticks moving. So deer are often the largest thing on the landscape that appear as a host for these ticks. So used to not have populations of black-legged ticks. I can't point to any research that says deer are the impact.
But they're everywhere now.
But yes, they're there. But think about this from the number of squirrels, mice, rats, feral cats. House cats are one of the bigger carriers of ticks. So deer get a lot of bad press for ticks and Lyme disease, but there's many vectors or animals that transport those ticks.
That was Gary Comer, who works for the Ohio Division of Wildlife. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And thank you to Robin Stewart, manager for the City of Worthington. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.